Unlike with David Broder, I am not going to give the next two speakers elaborate introductions. When Rui Teixeira, in his two books, Why Americans Don't Vote, which was published in 1987, and The Disappearing American Voter, tried to explain through polling data what were the changes in attitudes in America that might have contributed to lower voter turnout, he identified three. One is was a decline in people's sense of the efficacy of their vote or whether their vote mattered. The second is somewhat relevant to what we've been talking about and what Andy Schwartzman will be talking about, which is a decline in newspaper reading as the primary source of information on politics and public affairs. And the third was a decline in allegiance and strong allegiance to either major political party. I was searching around for who would be very thoughtful and knowledgeable critics of each political party. And I think I found two wonderful ones. Congressman Mickey Edwards was a congressman from Oklahoma for 16 years until he became the victim of the right-wing revolution in his state. He ascended to positions of leadership within the party and within Congress. He has subsequently turned his energies and his mind to trying to develop creative leadership, to teach people, in various places, the Aspen Institute, Institute for Government at Harvard, Princeton, what he has learned about American politics and what he, and what can be done to improve it. So I'm going to let him talk first about the Republican Party, and then I'll introduce Vic Fazio for the Democratic Party. Mickey?
Is it okay if I talk about the Democratic Party, too?
You can talk about whatever you want.
I'll try to do that.
Well, Vic gets equal time.
Right. Well, thank you, Kurt, for giving me a chance to do this. I know that you worked hard to find a couple of very thoughtful, reflective people. You found Vic, and then said, "Well, I got to find somebody else to be up there with him." And
I got you first.
I appreciate it. Your notes said to try to keep it brief, and I want to do that so that we have a lot of time for discussion and questions. And I will not really get into too much about what I think about the predictions where the parties are going to be going in terms of success. But, the question was about the strength of the parties, the strength of the parties, and where the how the parties are doing. Are they healthy? Are they well? I want to say both political parties, Democrats and the Republicans, are doing very well. They are very disciplined. They are very effective. They stay on message. They are very articulate in framing political arguments and getting those arguments heard. It's a political scientist's dream. You know, the parties as shorthand for particular divisions in the country. So from a political science perspective, I would say the answer to that first question is that the political parties are alive and well. And that is very bad for democracy and very bad for America. I think we are in a period where the parties, especially as exemplified by their leading voices, the voices whether in the administration or in the Congress, have forgotten actually what they are about and what their jobs are and what their responsibilities as the voices of a political party are. So before I look at the parties individually, and I will do that a little bit, I'd like to look at the Congress, which is the face of the Democratic Party, and to a lesser extent, because there's a Republican president, the face of the Republican Party. I try to be subtle. I don't like to be too direct. So let me say, kind of work my way gently around this by saying that the Congress of today is completely and utterly dysfunctional. And that fact, the fact that the Congress is dysfunctional, and by that I mean dysfunctional as a Congress. Not that it has failed to pass Bill A or Bill B, that it has failed to deal with the immigration problem, or that it has failed to deal with any particular problem you might want to mention, but in performing its duties and obligations under the Constitution as a Congress. And I would say that that fact is attributable equally to both the Democrats and Republicans. So that's true even though Republicans currently do control the institution, both houses. The Founding Fathers believed that they were separating us from the kind of systems that had existed in Europe, particularly in Great Britain, where power was centralized in an executive with a great deal of authority, and that authority actually got its strength not only from the office of the executive, the king, but from the fact that there is a parliamentary system in which the king's party, you know, was essentially expected to do what the king wanted. That has continued now without a king, but the prime minister. And the founders said, we're going to change that. We're going to make a fundamental break. And we're going to make a fundamental break because we're going to create a system in which there are equal and independent branches, thoroughly independent, completely independent, elected differently, and with different obligations, different powers, different authorities, and which I would like to spell out, are not so much powers of the Congress, but constitutional obligations of the Congress. And each branch was to serve as a check on the others. We had three branches. Today we have two parties. The three branches have been replaced by a parliamentary system of two parties and the majority party following the lead of the head of the administrative branch. To the point that today, as I look at the Congress, I find that there is a driving force, there is a spirit, there is an animus in the Congress, and it is not necessarily to do good. It is not necessarily, if you are a Democrat, to advance what Democrats have always traditionally believed the right thing for government to do. Or if you're a Republican, to advance the principles that have been stated in Republican platforms. I've read every Republican platform back to 1956. They were all fairly consistent for the most part. But the animus today is political advantage, partisan advantage. And that is the driving force. And it's the driving force not just for the party that's in control, but for the minority party too. For Republicans, and let me say, for the party which controls the Congress and has a member of its party in the White House, because I don't think things would be terribly different if control switched in either case, Republican members of Congress today basically believe they have taken an oath of office to serve as members of the White House staff. That it is their job to implement the policies, the programs that are put forth by the executive branch. Now remember, back in the days when there was a Soviet Union and we had a Communist Party USA, one of the things that those of us who were not of that persuasion would laugh about would be that whenever the orders came down from Moscow, the Communist Party USA would change its position. It would reverse itself because they had gotten new orders, which said a lot for the degree of principle that guided them. But today you see the Republican Party, which is in control of the Congress, reversing its position on stands it has taken over many, many years because the president wants them to do so, and the president is perceived not as the head of a separate branch of government, but as the head of their team. In this case, you know, the red team. And so you have seen, let me put these in the sense of the general perspective of the Democrats, from my view, has been that there should be stronger government, stronger federal government, stronger centralization in the federal government, and there is a reason for that. Democrats have tended to believe that the purpose of government was to do good for people who needed the help of the government or to hold off the oppressors in the private sector, whatever. You know, they believe sincerely, honestly, you know, that there was a strong role for government, and they favored, you know, more concentrated power for to achieve those good ends, whereas Republicans opposed concentrated power. Republicans opposed centralization. And so now you see, over the last few years, where Republicans not only have clearly abandoned their opposition to more and more federal spending and more federal mandates, but I believe these are a couple of, poor Vic has heard this so many times, and Ron had heard that, you know, my pet peeves here, you know, things like term limits. Republicans became enamored of term limits, which had the effect of doing what? Had the effect of reducing the power of the legislative branch and increasing the power of the executive branch and line item veto. Now, I've got to say, there are things I try to be serious about, but some things just you have to laugh. When you guys were in charge of the, you big spending, you know, wild out of control guys, we're in control of the Congress, and we had a Republican president, first Reagan and then Bush, the first Bush. Republicans came up with their love affair with the line item veto. Now, previous Republican platforms had been opposed to the line item veto. But now because you guys controlled the spending, you were on appropriations, bad spot, of course, so was I, but you guys controlled the spending, and so it made some sense, even though it was constitutionally nutty, it made some sense to say, because we, the responsible people, don't control the Congress, and the responsible people only control the presidency, we will have a line item veto so that the president can control you guys. Did you notice in the last State of the Union speech, when Republicans control the Congress, Republicans have a majority, 2-1, better than 2-1 on the Rules Committee, Republicans control the Appropriations Committee, the President of the United States asked for a line item veto, and Republicans cheered. To give away, you know, now that they're in charge, you know, it's kind of like, stop me before I kill again. You know, it's to take away their own power. Now, the Democrats, on the other hand, I think are doing exactly the same thing. And that is, the Democratic position has seemed to become, stop whatever the president wants. Stop what the president proposes. So that the executive branch is driving the system, whether you're for or against the president. You know, what you do is react to the executive branch's positions rather than having serious discussions on the merits. Now, if you look at the Congress, you look at the diversity of districts, you look at the diversity of populations, you look at the histories, the personal experiences of the members of Congress, it makes no sense to believe that on the merits, looking at each bill as it comes before you and deciding whether it's good or bad, you would automatically find yourself, if you're a Democrat, opposed to the president's view, and if you're a Republican, in support of the president's view. But what's happened is, I talked about the parties being well and healthy, and both parties are exercising iron discipline. There was an article in the Post the other day that described how, I mean, she's a little nicer about it, perhaps, but you could call Nancy Pelosi the hammer, too. Because both parties crack down and do not permit their individual members to stray from the party line, to stray from the leadership, or in one case, supporting the president's positions or opposing them. So I would argue that James Mattis, the lesson of 2000, the lesson of the 21st century, the lesson of 2006, is that what James Madison proposed so many years ago about the danger of factions has finally come home to roost. In the earlier panels, I heard, you know, discussions of the polarization, and not just polarization, that's part of politics, but the nastiness that pervades the polarization, which is precisely what James Madison was worried about. So let me quickly say something about how the parties have changed. That was the second part of Kurt's question, you know, how the parties have changed. And then the third part was about, you know, the future, which I'll wait till questions, but I'll have one comment about it, but that's all. First, let me, if I may, because Vic gets the final word, you know, let me say a word about the other guys, the Democrats, because I think both parties have changed. And the Democrats were once a coalition of Eastern academics, mostly pretty liberal, progressive reformers, and blue-collar workers, blue-collar ethnic America. The working class and ethnic populations have largely been written out of the Democratic Party. So that today, Democrats can appeal to the working class and lower income Americans almost exclusively on economic issues. And they have pretty good economic issues. Healthcare, access and affordability on healthcare, tax equity, trade barriers to protect American jobs. But there is fairly ample evidence that many Americans, and particularly Americans in lower socioeconomic classes, often vote on social and cultural issues, even if that vote may be perceived as being against their own short-term economic interests, which is part of the answer to why the conservative Republican candidates carry the poorest states in the country. The states that are the most economically affluent do tend to vote for the Democrats, and the states with the largest number of poor, struggling, you know, trying to dig out a living workers are the ones who continue to elect Republicans. And I think that's one reason why only two Democrats have been elected president in the last 41 years, both of them religious Southerners who denied that they were liberals, one of them proudly proclaiming the end of welfare as we know it. But the changes in the Republican Party have been equally profound and even more disturbing. In the Democratic Party, there's an evolution. When you have coalitions, some gain strength, other parts lose strength, and your positions evolve. What has happened with my party is not so much a reversal of previous positions, although that has clearly happened. We talked about that, you know, whether it's on spending or opposition to centralized power. You know, but what's happened instead, and by the way, let me just say, in terms of how the positions of the Republican Party have changed, I gave a speech Saturday night in Williamsburg, and one of the people who came to, I was, you know, billed as, you know, this conservative speaker, and I got an email this morning from one of the people who was there, who was very upset, you know, because she had come to the meeting, you know, to hear this conservative speaker, you know, and heard just another liberal. And the reason that she had concluded I was another liberal was that I had taken such outrageous positions as being concerned about wiretapping without warrants, ignoring constitutional mandates, all of the things. Every position I took was a traditional, long-standing, half-century-long Republican conservative position. And it drove the conservatives of today's conservatives in the audience nuts. You know, because they couldn't imagine, you know, where this was coming from. Let me just say this. My view, and I'll say just a word about where I think it's going, but I think even worse than Democrats having abandoned a very important part of their coalition is that Republicans seem to have abandoned almost any principle at all except to win power and to hold power. And that seems to be the Republican philosophy of the moment. Where do I think it's going? Let me just say this. It's easy to predict at the moment that Republicans might lose control of the House or the Senate or even both. I don't know that that's the case. And the reason I don't know that that's the case is that the rise in support for Democrats and the fall off of support for Republicans is largely tied to the president. And it's not so much tied to the president's policies. There is not a lot of indication that if you break policy questions down one at a time, that the people have turned away from the president's policies, although there's a lot of opposition to the war. The president's problems are arrogance and incompetence. And those are personal characteristics of the president and people around him. But Republicans are not so stupid in this next election to run the election based on support for the president. Just as Newt Gingrich nationalized the elections, this year Republicans are going to localize the elections, and it's going to be individual members of Congress running in their own districts based on the policy positions and the service they've provided to their constituents. Helpful for the Democrats is that arrogance and incompetence, once you have those, the administration can become competent overnight, but it's hard to change the perceptions. You know, in November, people are still going to see this administration as arrogant and incompetent, even if they become more competent in the meantime. But one of the things the Democrats cannot control is, number one, the localization, where Republicans already control more seats. And secondly, thank God, if you are a Republican, Democrats have never failed to find a way to blow it. And so maybe we have a chance, Vic, to hold power. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you, Mickey. I would add to arrogance and incompetence the most dangerous one of all, which is untrustworthiness right now. That one can kill you. Well, we get the other side probably commenting on both parties too. But Representative Vic Fazio, beat Representative Edwards, in terms of longevity in Congress by 4 years. He was in Congress for 20, and he also was in positions of leadership, both in the party and in Congress. He is very, very familiar with running the Democratic political fortunes, at least for Congress. Unlike his counterpart on the stage, he moved from Congress to a law firm, but what he has been exercising his considerable talents is essentially improving the leadership and giving wise counsel on policy. So there are two sides of the same coin. occupying different places in our society, but both of these people deserve our respect, and I'm very happy to have Vic here.
Thank you, Curtis, and I appreciate the effort everybody's making today to focus on a very sick system that we're all part of. Curtis has been looking at this issue longer than most, and I appreciate the fact that he's still fighting the good fight. Yeah. Mickey was always someone I respected in Congress. He was a truly honest intellectual Republican. And I must say that even more now that we're both retired, do I find his perspective and insights something I can almost totally agree with. It's amazing how we converge once we retire, those of us who serve in Congress. When you talk about the Democratic Party, it's traditional to start with a phrase perhaps from Finley Peter Dunne or Will Rogers to the effect that I'm not a member of an organized political party, I'm a Democrat. Well, that was said back in the era when the FDR coalition was formed and still the predominant political power in the country. A lot of things have changed. Some of them more recent, much of them have been alluded to here today. We talked to Taylor Branch and David Broder about the decline of the one-party South, the Democrats, that not only controlled their region, but very often the Congress, and had tremendous influence within the various Democratic White Houses of that era. So when the decline of the Roosevelt coalition was finally completed in the ascendancy in the 80s and 90s of Southern Republicans, really beginning with the Goldwater election of 64, which saw a number of Republicans elected to Congress, the Democratic Party has been forced to go through a metamorphosis. There have been lots of things that have brought the Democrats closer together. Nothing concentrates the mind like prolonged periods in the political wilderness and constant defeat. And we've had a lot more of that than we've had victory, as Mickey's just indicated. Our dwindling numbers in Congress reflect dwindling numbers in the American electorate. I would think that no more than 20% of America would describe itself unaided as liberal. My district was 15%. There's no question that in recent years, Republicans have decided to stop cooperating with conservative or moderate Democrats and decided it was better to replace them with Republicans. So Nancy Pelosi's caucus has come much closer together because the people in it are much more alike, and of course, there are fewer of them. Now, we still have diversity, a lot of it, but no longer do we have people who are really more allied with the other party. We've had party switchers, and we've had those more recently, like Charlie Stenholm of Texas, a very fundamentally conservative individual who was defeated by the Republican reapportionment in the year 2004, the Tom DeLay second cut at Texas reapportionment. So it's concentrated the minds of those kinds of people. I'd think of Colin Peterson, the chairman of the Ag Committee in the House, who have become far more loyal to their party, far more supportive of their leaders. Much of Nancy Pelosi's effectiveness in galvanizing her majority comes from the fact that the other party gives no safe harbor anymore for members of the Democratic Party who would routinely cross the aisle. Nancy is also the first leader I've ever experienced, and I served with O'Neill and Wright and Foley and Gephardt, who actually gave Democrats the impression that their votes would matter in terms of their advancement in the institution. We grew so fat and happy with all those huge majorities of the 70s and into the 80s that nobody worried about lining up the green votes. We let the Democrats who needed to hog the reds. And it all culminated with the Clinton budget of 1993, when our party's leaders on committees that spend huge amounts of money couldn't vote for their president's deficit reduction package. And of course, we were put on the pike by a Republican Party who would not offer one vote to the greater good. It was their job, finally, after Newt Gingrich overthrew Bob Michael, to take a confrontational role, a line in the sand that said, Democrats have to govern. We're not going to help them. Amazingly, Democrats have learned a lot from that experience and now are implementing exactly the same approach as Republicans struggle increasingly to pass fundamental measures like, for example, Thursday night, the budget resolution. In Europe, the government would have fallen. Here, everybody went home for 2 weeks to lick their wounds and find out whether or not there was any common ground they could achieve on return. It's sometimes interesting to look at the parties through the prism of James McGregor Burns, the Williams College political scientist who always divided the two parties between the legislative or congressional wing and the executive. If you look at the congressional wing of our party, and we've just been talking about Leader Pelosi, we tend to, in the Senate particularly, nominate people for leader who come from, if not red states, perhaps purple states. You think of Montana and Maine, West Virginia, South Dakota, and now Nevada. Democrats historically, I think Teddy Kennedy was in there for a few years, have been going toward the people who really represent the swing voter in the country, and whose senators are almost by definition not candidates for president, but people who can ride herd of over the other 99 senators who are, at least that share of them who are in their party. The executive wing is a much different phenomenon. Today, it's totally dominated by our past president, Bill Clinton. The Clinton aura continues to define the executive wing of our party, even to the point of, to some degree, overshadowing the interests of the senator from New York, who would hope to represent that wing at some point in the future. But you think about who we think of as future leaders of the party, it's women like Granholm and Sebelius and Napolitano, governors of Michigan and Kansas and Arizona. It's Bill Richardson in New Mexico, Vilsack in Iowa, and the Warner-Cain phenomena of Virginia. Even Senator Bayh runs for president as a governor. So we understand that our future is going to be through the executive wing of our party, and there is where a lot of the attention has to be spent. David Broder talked a lot about this polarization. Mickey's referred to it. Largely, reapportionment has cemented a trend that was already underway. Both parties have conducted ruthless reapportionments, sequestering the partisans of both parties in separate districts. We have more minority representatives. We have far fewer white representatives who have minority constituents to take into consideration in their political decision-making. Democrats have become increasingly limited in their fundraising base. Organized labor, even in decline and disarray, is still the major source of funding, and the trial bar is the other. Increasingly, a new phenomena, and that is internet-based fundraising, really pioneered by John McCain, but certainly a continual factor through MoveOn.org and others in bringing donors, some progressive, some simply looking for change, to various campaigns around the country. John Kerry raising sizable sums from within his campaign base for candidates for Congress and the Senate. The same for Howard Dean, really the reason he was selected to be party chairman. The internet may be one of the keys to a changing perspective in the Democratic Party, because a new source of political support has been created. Mickey talked very aptly about the decline of the blue collar, largely ethnic and white base for the Democrats nationally. I think there may be some return to the fold in the next election, but it's still an ongoing phenomenon. The cultural issues have predominated. And Democrats are only now waking up to the fact that they have to talk about faith in how it factors into their political judgments. People like Reverend Doug Tanner from Faith and Politics Institute, Jim Wallace of the Sojourners, Bob Edgar at the National Council of Churches, all of these folks have talked to Democrats about how it's important, if you are a believer, to let someone know it and to share your faith-based values. Democrats have come only recently to that awareness. There's a growing polarization in the party between minority group members, increasingly Latinos, African-American participation fairly level, and new Asian Pacific Islander members elected, in stark contrast to suburban and the few remaining rural Democrats. The suburban new economy voters, those who are investors, social liberals, as Mickey described them earlier, the people who once were just the academicians back in the 30s, but who now really control a number of districts in our party, may be the future. But that future conflicts directly with the organized labor bloc, particularly and divisively on the trade issue. And the world, you know, having become flat, requires our party to focus specifically on that issue. But there's a new pragmatism in the party. It's possible for Nancy Pelosi and Jack Murtha, who are at opposite poles on the cultural issues, to make book and work closely together. I think of the way the Democratic Party performed in Pennsylvania 6 years ago when Ron Klink, a anti-abortion Democrat, could barely get traction against Rick Santorum. And perhaps we have to give Rick a lot of credit here, but today Bob Casey, with exactly the same views on abortion, is being broadly supported by the party, largely because Chuck Schumer, the chairman of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, focused on his electability and not that of a Republican woman who had become a Democrat who was pro-choice, who may well have been the nominee in a free fight. So the Democratic Party is becoming more pragmatic. It has learned, I think, through much trial and much error, to deal with the campaigns on gods and guns and gays, which have largely defined Republican gains in the last 15 to 20 years. Structurally, we're still very weak at the local level. That's one area I happen to agree with Howard Dean on, and that is that much more emphasis has to be placed there. We still have a DNC that doesn't have the complete confidence of the entire Democratic family, or we wouldn't have Harold Ickes close to Mrs. Clinton out organizing a separate database, because the confidence level at the DNC is not particularly high. But we have 527s, at least for a while, who became a huge source of funding, not for partisan Democrats, but for progressive interests. And that group has moved largely into a new camp. An alliance of donors has come together in the Democratic Party to try to build the infrastructure that Republicans started building in 64 and 74 after their huge losses. The last 40 years of Republican rebuilding of that infrastructure, media centers, think tanks, party building activity, is only something the Democrats are just beginning to do. But it really was an outcome of the last election, where large individual Democratic donors concluded they weren't any more interested in just funding the latest candidate. They wanted to do something fundamental to redirect the American electorate. Be interesting to see how far they get. In addition to the internet as a fundraising mechanism, the blogosphere has now become a huge factor in the Democratic Party's effort to bring more people into the dialogue. The decline of newspaper readers and news watchers has made the Democrats focus more on people who are online all the time and who may get most of their information and news through that medium. This is, I think, a huge opportunity for us in the future. Our think tanks have been there for years. You know, we've got people on the left, center, and right of the party, but none of them have been adequately funded, and hopefully in the future we will see more of that kind of effort, one that I think can really bring about a refertilization of the Democratic idea base. We have been running not on empty, but close to it for a long time, and only recently have we begun to come up not only with some new ideas, but new approaches to the American electorate from where they stand, not where we would like them to stand. If you notice, in recent months, the Democrats have been focusing on national security, an area which has been a historic weakness. I notice largely, I think, because of the Dubai port deal and Iraq and perhaps the response to Katrina, the Republican-Democratic division on national security is now 41-41 based on a recent AP Ipsos poll. So Democrats have been making progress. But I think as we look to the future, just briefly, we look to what's happening all across the country today and yesterday, and that is the increasing political awareness of Latinos and other immigrant groups who've come to this country, sometimes under political duress, often in search of economic futures. That electorate, combined with the large group of young people who are really getting interested but don't yet have an orientation to either party, I think will determine ultimately what happens in our party's future and the ensuing battles in 2006 and 2008, I think, are going to be very, very close. Reapportionment greatly advantages the Republicans in the short run. The Democrats, as was said earlier, did their greatest get-out-the-vote effort in their history, and they can do it again in 2008, but they have got to have a message that will bring those swing voters from places where partisanship is not particularly embedded into the process and to their candidates. I was talking to a Northern California friend of mine the other day who was critical of Nancy Pelosi for not taking the liberal message nationwide. And I said, you have to realize Nancy's campaigning in 50 seats that sit somewhere close to the middle of America. That is the focus the Democrats must have, and that's what their leaders must address. The national message, the overriding involvement of people 3 years hence is really based on the success of our nominee. And that increasing pragmatism in our party leads me to think we may well have a fighting chance in that election. Thank you.
Questions?
Do you both believe that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely? If so, can't you make the case that with the exception of the so few competitive political races throughout the country, that absolute corruption is at play with both Republicans and Democrats, red and blue, conservative and liberal? Are we beyond hope, or should we perhaps give more respect and consideration to a Ralph Nader, Pat Buchanan, Ross Perot, or even Jesse Ventura? And can't we and shouldn't we celebrate real, pure, moral, ethical religion's role in politics?
Well, first of all, the quote is not that absolute power corrupts absolutely. It is that absolute power tends to corrupt absolutely, which means that it's not a foregone conclusion that it will happen. There's certainly a danger, when power is concentrated. And I think we do have to concern ourselves. I'm not ready to quite take that position, but a lot of people have made the argument that probably the government would function better if one of the two houses were controlled, by a party not of the president, unified government may in fact, cause some of the problems that we're having now. I'm not endorsing a Democratic takeover of either house. But in terms of where you then went with your question, I think the fact that both parties are having considerable problems today with their philosophies and their performance does not make Ralph Nader or Jesse Ventura or anybody else, any more sane than they were before. So I mean, I'm not quite inclined to think that's the answer to the problem.
I would think that the people you mentioned who have been third-party candidates or potential candidates in the future are likely to make an impact on the margins. I think you could probably argue Ross Perot had the greatest effect on the political process in his run against the first President Bush. But I think it's much more likely that the parties that we know will change. I don't think another rip-on experience, which was the rise of the Republicans in 1856 and the ultimate decline and extinction of the Whig Party, is in the offing. I do think both parties are up for review and change from internal factors. And that really relates to who joins them and who tries to take the lead in them. There's still an awful lot of opportunity to do that. In Congress, it's easy to kind of accept your old saying. I would think the Democrats who were in charge up until 94 may have given the appearance of corruption because there were problems around the institution. Most of them were not totally Democrats, but the collateral damage on the Republican side was forgotten. And it was one of the arguments for change in 94. And of course today, with Tom DeLay and Nancy Pelosi's campaign against the culture of corruption in the House, you have some of the same phenomena. But really what happens is when the parties get in trouble and their positions and their advocacy on issues does not continue to earn a majority, when their party is on the line, they begin to use the subterfuge of closed rules or cutting off the minority's right to debate. And those things really, I think, are the corruption we should worry most about, because that is what transforms our representative democracy into a mockery. And both parties, sometimes I think the Democrats didn't even realize they had almost imperceptibly moved into that. I think Tom DeLay really represented an approach on the Republican side that was absolutely take no prisoners, party line votes, give no quarter, shut them down. I think it's probably one of the major factors that have unified the Democrats. The procedural issues cut across ideology.
Taylor?
Well, in addition to the increasing strength of the parties, how much of the partisanship that you witnessed today in the Congress can you attribute to the fact that they don't seem to know each other as well as they used to in the old days? Or is that a direct result of the strength of the parties?
Well, I think it's...
Or the schedule.
I think that's a big factor. When members of Congress came to Washington for 6 months and went home for 6 months, they socialized together, they knew each other. But that was an era, I should say, when Congress was far more homogeneous in itself. In recent years, the rise of the jet aircraft and the cell phone and, you know, the laptop and all those phenomena have buttressed the desire of members of Congress to spend more time at home, campaigning, fundraising, less and less time in Washington. As a result, they go to meeting after meeting and get on the plane again, rarely interacting with anyone outside their committees or their conference or caucus. There is no commonality of understanding, and in a more diverse and divergent Congress than existed 30, 40, 50 years ago, that is needed even more. So I totally agree with your thesis that Congress doesn't know itself. It almost looks at itself in the stereotypes of each party, and that is absolutely poisonous.
Yeah, Ron, I testified before the House Rules Committee recently on the question of lobbying reform and putting bans on privately funded travel and all of these things. And I made a point, I mean, you remember David Obie, and Dave was the chairman of the subcommittee that I was on. I was ranking member of the Foreign Operations Subcommittee, and Dave was its chairman. Dave's very liberal. We didn't agree on very much at all. But we had opportunities to travel together, and I got to know Dave as a person. You know, Dave and I don't know how many people know this, Dave and his wife and his kids, you know, are wonderful musicians. They record. I got to know them as a family. I spent, because I was in Washington a lot on weekends. I spent time with friends of mine who were Democrats and got to know them as people. And that has been lost. And I agree with Vic that there are a lot of different factors that are causing people to head out of town as soon as they can. Part of it is that the division between the two parties is so close, you know, that people are really worried about their own re-elections. But that's fixable. One of the things that would fix it is if we got away from the Tuesday, Thursday long recess kind of schedules and kept members of Congress in town longer, where they had a chance to get to know each other. More importantly, their families got to know each other. I think that would be a big step. Right now, if Vic and I were in Congress today, the chance, I don't know whether I would know him. I know he's Democrat, I'm a Republican, you know, and therefore, you know, there's a problem there. There's something really wrong with him. And, you know, that can be fixed by changing the way the congressional schedule works. The other thing Vic referred to that would make a difference, when you force somebody to cast a vote, then they have to be thinking not just about their party loyalty or party pressures. They have to worry about their constituencies. And one of the things you could do is if you got rid of closed rules, or largely got rid of closed rules, and Jim Wright became a big advocate of them, and that's one of the things that led to the Gingrich revolution. But if you opened up the process, had fewer closed rules, so that members were able to offer amendments, and every member of the House was then required to vote on those amendments, you would have more crossing of the line, because you would not want to antagonize your constituents.
One cultural phenomenon that's been overlooked in this whole debate, it isn't that just going to Washington and becoming part of it sets you up for your opponent's attack. Going to Washington has never been healthy, and this has been a vast overreaction to that, is that there are more and more spouses employed, and they don't want to give up their careers to come to Washington.
Right, that's a good point.
Last question.
Yes, I'd like to ask a question about, it's very interesting, the original thought that against the conventional wisdom that maybe the parties are weakening and we're having trouble, you're saying the parties are very strong, but the country is suffering. I think that's original thought, and they're changing. And neither party, it strikes me, it's harder in both parties to make what I would regard as constitutional, three co-equal branches of government positions. And I'm thinking of both of them. Long before Iraq, one of the first things President Bush did was essentially to announce that he would not obey the Presidential Records Act, with an executive order that I would have thought would get the Supreme Court upset because he's usurping its role. He essentially declared it unconstitutional, and the Congress upset in both parties that he's, you know, essentially disregarding a law that they passed, and yet I didn't hear from any of them making constitutional arguments. And on the Democratic side, when Russ Feingold essentially said, we can wiretap all we want, but wouldn't it be nice to have a check and balance and have a judge look at it to make sure we're not wiretapping our neighbor or making, you know. He couldn't get any Democrats to make a constitutional argument. They all ran. So it seems to me that both parties don't really make constitutional co-equal branch of government arguments any longer the way they used to.
I think you've made, you know, a tremendous point. Let me tell you two things that stand out in my mind as wonderful moments in the history of the Congress. One was during World War II, there was a Democratic president, Franklin Roosevelt. Democrats controlled both the House and the Senate. They could literally do whatever they wanted to do. And a Democratic senator named Harry Truman investigated the Democratic Defense Department, was before the War Department, that had been appointed and run by a Democratic president, and found a lot of wrong. I mean, can you imagine Bill Frist investigating George Bush? The other moment that struck me was when Ronald Reagan was president, and you know, I don't know whether Democrats would recognize this, But Ronald Reagan was more than just the Republican leader. He was really beloved by Republicans. He, you know, as an individual, and Reagan had all of us Republicans to the White House because he had agreed to go along with a tax increase. He made a very emotional appeal that his credibility was on the line and he needed us, and we all, you know, took it very seriously and went back, and two-thirds of the Republicans in the House voted against him and two-thirds of the Republicans in the leadership voted against him. Now, whichever side you think we should have been on, the thing was we didn't just follow the lead of the president. So when I took an oath of office, I took an oath of office to America, to the Constitution, not to the president. And when I read about people who, you know, including people not just in Congress, but people who work for the White House, who believe that their obligation is to be loyal to the president, whether the president is George W. Bush or Lyndon Johnson or whoever else, you know, that's a scary, scary thought. You know, your loyalty is to your country and your and its Constitution, not to an individual.
I think if you look back on the Carter administration, you can see where the Democrats in Congress, the congressional wing of the party, didn't particularly treat the gentleman from Georgia with any great deference. Oversight was a normal process that Congress did. Part of the phenomenon of not being there very often leads directly to the lack of time to do oversight. And often a lot of what Congress does most effectively is done in that sort of setting, not dealing with a piece of legislation maybe down the road, but certainly looking into the performance of the executive branch. There's been a total prohibition on doing that. We had one hearing on Abu Ghraib, one of the greatest foreign policy defeats of the country, by John Warner, and he was shut down immediately, and none other occurred. I mean, I think this is really dereliction of constitutional responsibility. I have to say, on the Democratic side at the moment, Democrats are not anxious to stimulate the Republican base by talking impeachment or other factors. They know that Republican base suppression is just as big a phenomenon today as Democratic base suppression was in 1994, when we had failed to deliver on national health care, and our people stayed home. We don't want to give them the foil to raise money and turn out in the election. We want to focus on the other party. And that has caused voices like Russ Feingold to be in a distinct minority.
I want to thank our two speakers for a very thoughtful presentation on the issue of structure of Congress. At about 2:10, Norm Ornstein will be here for the next panel. The problem, you know, this means I'm shortening your lunch, but I'm shortening your lunch because we have got to get out of here, this building, at 4:45, because there's a service at 5. And you know, we want to cover both panels of the afternoon, and so I got to get the railroad running. Becky Prosky over there has chits for lunch. She will, you know, there's a map there which will tell you where lunch is, and we will start no later than 2:10, whether you're here or not. Thank you.